As the quarter goes all the way up through the Greeks, and we've seen them take over. We've seen them fragment under the four generals. We looked at the two, Ptolemy and Seleucid, that actually fought over the Jewish area there and how that went on. And then we saw these Maccabees and this Hasmonean dynasty that come into existence, that existed while the remnants of the Greek influence or powers were still there, and Rome had came in beginning to have power in the area. But one of the ones we didn't mention under this Hasmonean dynasty time was Alexandra. She was the wife of that Alexander Janius, who had been appointed. He had appointed her queen and put her in power at that time in the area there of Palestine. And the reason that we mention her is because she had two sons, Hyrcanus, and she also had a son, Aristobulus. And the reason we mention these is because these are the two brothers, at least half-brothers. She put one into power that the Pharisees favored as high priest. We remember that the Pharisees were the sect that held to the strict orthodox part of the Jewish faith. Well, she puts her son in as the high priest, but her younger son, or her youngest son, Aristobulus, wanted to be king. And so the Sadducees attached themselves and found favor with him. And the reason that we mention these things is because when we come into the atmosphere that existed in the early church, we see these tensions between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. We see the hatred that existed between the Jews and the Samaritans. And when we go back and we look at the history and the Bible, that between those, it gives you a good idea of what these feelings were based on. After this, the death of Alexandra, this one son, these two sons begin to war and fight, to make the story short, over control of the area. And as these play out, the end of this Hasmonean dynasty dies with these brothers because they're fighting over it. Rome is pretty much stayed out and let the end of these powers kind of go as they were on their own. But when these two brothers begin to war amongst each other, one tries to side with some Arabs, and Rome realized that that was a problem, and finally Pompey, who was from Rome then, was the emperor of Rome, sends a general, Scaurus, in to stop this rising. He wants this civil unrest put to an end to get rid of these things. This general of Pompey's goes in, and through bribery, he decides to support one of those brothers and get rid of the other. But Pompey later on questions the loyalty of them, and he finally just comes into Jerusalem. He finally just marches in, attacks Jerusalem. He conquers it. He enters in person into the temple and the Holy of Holies. When he does this, he takes this other brother, Hyrcanus, and confirms him as the high priest and high priesthood, and appointed him as the ethnarch of Judea, and adds this area of Jerusalem to that Syrian region. So as that ends, you see Jerusalem and all that now conquered by the Romans. They finally just went in and took over and put their presence in there, added it to the Syrian region that they're over. And that's where we leave that study of that Maccabean and that Hasmonean dynasty. So now the Roman Empire is in existence. It's in place. This Antiochus III, that Seleucid, remember Seleucid was one of the generals left behind by Alexander that got the part that ruled over Syria. This will be backing up about 200 B.C., he made that last-ditch effort to try to stop the Romans and failed at that. We mentioned that earlier. And since then, they've been under a heavy tax. But when Pompey steps in, as we just mentioned, and he puts this civil dispute to rest, he quenches that out between these two brothers. He ends up taking the side of this one Hyrcanus and appoints him high priest and ethnarch over Judea. He rules Judea, Galilee area, the Idumea, and Perea. Remember the Idumea region, because that's going to be important here later on. And they pay this tribute to Rome. In 63 B.C., which is very close to the time of Christ, just a matter of 63 years, the Jews finally lose their independence when Pompey reels them in again under his yoke. And pretty much from that time forward, 63 B.C. on, you see this kindled nationalism of the Jews, this hatred, this rebellious nature of them really come into existence and never stop. We mentioned that the other day, or the other lesson or two back. They have this rebellious or revolting attitude toward the Jews, and that carries through all the way through to 70 A.D. when we know the destruction of Jerusalem finally occurs. So these are the times that's leading up to the time of Christ, the first century. This is before Jerusalem is destroyed in 70 A.D. We mentioned the Idumean. This was an area. The Idumeans were actually descendants of the Edomites. So we know our history with the Edom and with the Israelites. So we know there's trouble there, but Antipater was a ruler there. He was one of those Edomians, and he paved the way for Herod. He gets involved in these political alliances, and he swings a lot of weight down in that bottom area from these descendants of the Edomites, and he begins to broker power to the powers that be around him. So he becomes very, very important. He's mentioned in history as being crafty, wealthy, and powerful. These descendants of the ancient Edomites, they've been pushed out of their territory southeast of the Dead Sea by those Arabs that we talked about. Now they lived in an area around Hebron. That Nabatean Arabs were the ones that helped that. But now they're relocated around Hebron. And they have been compelled to be part of Judea. So that's the atmosphere with them. But their broker in power, he's very important, that Antipater, the Edomite, because he's helping Herod, who's going to come into power. He persuaded some of the powers even within them to rebel and to work. But his influence continues to grow. And he supported Pompey until he died in 47 B.C. Antipater was made governor of Judea, and Roman citizenship was conferred on him. But he was hated by the Jews all along. And why? Because he was had that Edomite history, that bloodline that was behind him. But Antipater had two sons, Phasael and Herod. So Caesar ends up assassinated in 44 B.C. Antipater was poisoned by his enemies, but he's got his sons left behind, Phasael and Herod. later on in the Roman power, and as things shift and emperors leave and come and go and places shift around, Antony and Octavian end up declaring this Herod is king of Judah, and he comes in with the help of the Romans. He takes possession of Galilee and Judah and all that. So he's kind of, Herod has came to power there under the Romans and with the Romans. And the reign of Herod the Great begins in 37 B.C. and lasts all the way up to 4 B.C. So he comes up almost to the birth of Christ. Although Palestine kind of remains semi independent in certain aspects until Herod's death. I guess the last say or the real power, the final say over that area still laid in the hands of whoever Rome had set as over that Syrian region. In other words, there was areas within these larger regions, and whoever had the seat of power over these Roman regions actually had the last say. And that was right before the procurators came. Procurators come later on, the Roman procurators, Pontius Pilate and all them. So throughout this period of the New Testament, as we look at it, the shadow of Rome is always over it. It's kind of a hard thing to explain. Even though it's under oppression by the Romans, God has created an atmosphere through that oppression that actually allows Christianity to come into place and to actually thrive even in place of this. Think about what the Jews are still expecting. They're still expecting this physical king that's going to come, that's going to take them out of all this. So during this time, as this is going on, when Christ comes on the scene, once again we see another reason why Christ was overlooked, was marked off, because they were looking for something to get them out of these situations that were had. All the while, God is playing out His providence by bringing Jesus Christ into the world. He's priming the world in that area for this. Christianity actually ends up flourishing, you know, under that, even though they're under these Roman procurators. Let's talk about some of those for just a second. As they come into power, 26 to 36 A.D., this would have been after Christ was born, 26 to 36 A.D., Pontius Pilate is on the scene as a Roman procurator. Pilate was probably the fifth one that was over the region of Judea, because, see, we've jumped all the way up to 26 A.D., so there had been a little time that had passed there, but he was the fifth procurator of Judea. According to history, Pilate made an immediate bad impression on the Jews when he moved his army headquarters in from Caesarea to Jerusalem. And it's the way he did that that really, really offended the Jews. He marched his standards in with his own image as a divine being. And he marches in under force and sets up his army headquarters in one of the corners of the temple, where the temple was, and builds his military headquarters there. And these Jews really, really take outrage and object to that. Pilate gets a lesson really quick about how zealous that these Jews were and how anti-oppression they were. They'd had enough of this, and he realized that they were going to be problems to handle. According to the historians, he recognized this. He ends up ordering these standards, or this symbol of his power and his military headquarters, moved back to Caesarea and gets out of that. So Josephus is one of our famous historians that recorded a lot back in the time that we're looking at. And he gave an account of what happened to Pontius Pilate. And in his recordings of what happened at this time with Pontius Pilate, he mentions that a religious fanatic arises in Samaria. A great multitude of these people came to this sacred mountain of the Samaritans. Remember when we talked about the Samaritans and how they built their own temple on Mount Gerizim, or whatever it was called? I think that was the name of it. As they revolt and resist them, they amass this big group, head to this mountain, and Pilate's cavalry attacks them, and there were a lot of them that were slaughtered. And this word gets back to Rome, and Rome pulls Pontius Pilate. He pulls them out and sends them back. That makes room for M. Antonius Felix. That would have been A.D. 52 to 59. So this is getting up closer to the destruction of Jerusalem. We're seeing the tensions build. We're seeing this resistance from the Jews to the Romans as it's coming in. And as Felix comes in, he's the procurator of Judea, Samaria, Galilee, and Perea. We remember him as the judge of Paul, of the Apostle Paul. But he had a really oppressive rule that caused even more resentment and more revolt from the Jewish nation. And it just strengthened or added fuel to this anti-Roman party. So in 59 to 61, this Porcius Festus takes over in place of Felix. He's the successor to Felix. We read of him assuming that position in Acts 24 and verse 27, of where it mentions there of him, the procurator of Judea. A few weeks after he enters his office, one of the first things he encounters is the case of Paul comes before him. So he's in prison. Paul is at this time at Caesarea, and he was considered pretty just in his administration of the province. He goes down to Caesarea, and he heard Paul defend himself in the presence of Herod and Agrippa II and his sister Bernice. And he finds in him, if you'll remember, he's not worthy of death. He's not worthy of bonds. And he even made the comment, he would have set him free. He would have set Paul free at that time had Paul not made appeal to Rome as a Roman citizen. So that was our character that Paul was in front of. You find that in Acts 25, verses 11 and verse 12. Festus only serves 2 years. He dies in Judea. He had a very short term there, but a very important one because he did have interaction with Paul. And you might say, well, Paul could have been free. Well, it was never God's plan for Paul to be free. Even though he was sympathetic, God's providence was being played out. Paul was going to Rome. So succeeding Festus was Florus, and he was there from 66 to 73 A.D., an important time in our Jewish history. Florus was a Roman procurator. He behaved much like an executioner, he's described as, or a robber. He looted and decimated whole cities within the province there and in that region of his own people that he was over. So you can imagine the hatred and the tensions that had already built between the Jews and the Romans. And then when this guy comes in, you see the worst of the worst taking place. And so you see the people, the Jewish people, just they're described as throwing caution to the wind. They're outright rebellious now. They don't care who knows it. They're public with it. They're going to rebel. They riot. They're completely out of control, being openly defiant. Florus goes in and takes 17 talents from the temple's treasury, and that was the straw that broke the camel's back with the Jews. They break out in riot, and they go into a state of disarray. And we see that playing up from 66 to 70 A.D. because that's when the Romans finally have enough, and they come in and they decimate or destroy Jerusalem. I thought it was interesting to see the history behind that and how that built up as God played out His providence. And the things that were prophesied in the Old Testament hundreds and hundreds of years before are being played out right before us. And we see how God orchestrated that. These Jews, they rebel, they riot, they have this confidence that God's going to send someone to the rescue and vindicate their cause. They're still They're still looking for that earthly king to come in and vindicate them. This Jewish war, more or less, with the Romans broke out, or this rebellious state broke out in 66. So we see how that played out. The time that we have left, I know we're going to lose a week, a lesson next week, but we need to spend the rest of our time. We're going to jump to the Herods, hit the Samaritans a little bit more on stuff that we've already touched on, but we didn't go in detail, and then finish up with the sects of the Jews, study on them, and the changes or the developments in the Jewish faith there in the last. So these Herods, we've already mentioned Herod the Great that came in to existence. He was the son of that Antipater that we mentioned, born in 74 B.C. He's made governor of Judea by his father at age 25. He reigned as king of the Jews from 37 to 4 B.C., as we mentioned. He was scheming, jealous, and cruel. He had his successors. His successors was Archelaus, ethnarch of Judah, and he was from 4 B.C. to about 6 A.D., 10 years there. He's mentioned in Matthew 2, verse 22. Another son he had was Herod Philip. He was the son of Cleopatra. He was tetrarch of Tyria and Trachonius from 4 B.C. to 34 A.D. Another son, Herod Antipas, tetrarch of Galilee from 4 B.C. to 39 A.D. We read about him in Matthew 14, 3 through 12, Mark 6, 17 through 29, Luke 13, 32, chapter 23, verses 7 through 12. His grandson was Herod Agrippa, of Herod, the first Herod, was Herod Agrippa the first, king of Judea from A.D. 37 to 44. Read about him in Acts chapter 12. And then Herod's great-grandchildren that was born to this Herod Agrippa the first was Bernice. She was consort of her brother Herod Agrippa the second. We read about her in Acts 25, verse 13. We have Herod Agrippa the second, tetrarch of Chalcis and the North Territories in 48 A.D. to 70 A.D. and Drusilla, who married Felix, the procurator of Judea from A.D. 52 to 59. So that was kind of a brief history. We don't have time to go into details on them of the Herods and how they went through their time frame there as powers. These Samaritans, a brief history and remind us some of the things that we talked about them before. We remember Samaria as being the capital city of the northern kingdom, don't we, of Israel. That's where they were located. It was captured by the Assyrians in 722 B.C., way back. We came up through the time of Christ, but we're jumping way back. These Assyrians capture the northern kingdom and take Samaria, and then we read about that in 2 Kings 17, verses 3 through 6, and 2 Kings 18, verses 9 through 11. And this is when the northern kingdom was taken off by the Assyrians for most part. We mentioned they were putting Halon, they were putting on Habor, they were putting on the river Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. So they've been dispersed, thrown out. In their absence, or the vacuum that was created there in Samaria, we see the Assyrians bring in foreigners from Babylon to populate it. Cufa, Ava, Hamath, Sepharvaim. They were all brought in and placed in these cities that were in Samaria. These people intermarried with what little was left of the northern kingdom, or the Israelites that were there, and became known as these Samaritans. 2 Kings 17, 24, and verse 29. So we see the deluded state of what was there. You see why these Jews that were in a better state, in a bloodline, had so much resentment against these Samaritans. They were looked at as foreigners. They were not looked at as true Jews. And so there was a hatred there between them. Now there was some similitude of Jewish history that was kind of left in place, you'd have to say, because you didn't see, as far as pagan worship and these Babylonians and all these others being brought in, you still saw some similitude and some effect in the Samaritans of still having some Jewish faith. But they were in a state that was very deluded. So when these Jews returned from captivity in 536, we just studied about that, when the southern kingdom comes back from a captivity in 536 B.C., we remembered in our study, when we were studying about Zerubbabel and some of the others, when they went back to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple, we remember that these Samaritans offered their aid or their help to help them build. And as we remember, they were flat out refused of that help. That's how much hatred was between these Jews and these Samaritans, that they refused that help. You can read about that in Ezra 4, verse 3, verse 10, verse 17. In these Maccabean times, Jewish tradition itself kind of represents these Samaritans as being joining with the Syrian oppressors or the remnants of these Seleucids, that Greek generals, people. So they're looked at as traitors, as enemies, not as Jews. Somewhere around 128 B.C., John Hyrcanus destroys the Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim in about 128 B.C. So see, they had their own temple on that mountain that they worshipped. It was totally out of parameter with the Jewish faith. So that was remnants and leftovers from the influence they had as the northern kingdom when it split and they went awry, and from the other forces that came in and influenced them. Don't know when that temple was built, but in John 4 and verse 20, you'll note that when Jesus sat down with the Samaritan woman, she mentioned to him at that time that our fathers worshipped in this mount. So there's even mention of it then. This temple, the ruins of it anyway, were visible from Jacob's Well. There's quite a bit wrote about it in an archaeological context. You can study that, but you can see by the New Testament times why the Jews and the Samaritans had absolutely no dealings whatsoever with one another. This Samaritan religion, they accepted only the Pentateuch, which we know is the first five books of the Old Testament. Nothing past that. They accepted nothing else. But it was their version, which had a great Greek influence, was very different from the Masoretic Hebrew text in a lot of places. For instance, you know, preference in their recordings or their Pentateuch, well, a lot of preference was given to that Mount Gerizim where the temple was, rather than Jerusalem. I think a small group of Samaritans, they claim, were still in existence, but they find a Sumerian papyri. It's a collection. They find this all the way up in the 1960s. But it's a collection of about 20 fragmentary Aramaic documents that were discovered 9 miles north of Jericho in 1962 to 1964. And it added a lot of information in this intertestamental period. It's mostly administrative stuff that was in it, but it's dated all the way back to 375 to 335 B.C. Reference is made in it to Antaxerxes II and Darius III, so that helps date it. We're going all the way back to the Medes, if you'll remember. The Medes that had came into power after the Babylonians. And it puts them just prior to Alexander's invasion in 332 B.C., so they could date it from the contents of it. There's a reference to Sanballat, governor of Samaria. That's thought to be Sanballat the third, though, and not the first that's mentioned in Nehemiah so much. But they look through these findings. One thing that the study from it brought out, it suggested this, I guess, historical setting, I guess you'd call it, where the people, the city of Samaria, initially integrated themselves or welcomed in this Alexander the Great and welcomed in this Greek influence. They later, ironically, end up, as we mentioned briefly early in our history, burn alive Alexander's prefect in Syria, kill him, and Alexander returns for vengeance and takes vengeance on the murderers. But it does shed some light on the historical atmosphere that was in place then. Alexander destroys the city of Samaria. They've found it since then. They've got the ruins. They've looked at that. It had a great Greek influence of where they had went through and became more or less Greek. It's probably to be explained by the fact that the Samaritans who fled Samaria rebuilt Shechem as their new capital and never came back and didn't come back to that. Just some miscellaneous information so we can get through this and be ready to start on something else next week. Herod the Great built Samaria as one of his magnificent cities. He dedicated a temple there to Emperor Augustus. One of his wives was a Samaritan who was the mother of Herod Antipas. And the Samaritans, ironically, they fall under the rule of the Roman procurators. And Josephus states that the Pilate's handling of a fanatical assembly on this mountain that we mentioned a while ago where he slaughtered all these people was what caused Pilate to be removed. But it became so bad that travel in that time, the Jews wouldn't even travel through Samaria. They would go around it. They'd travel along the Jordan Valley or through Perea on their way to Jerusalem. And we'll finish by making an ironic statement. As much hatred as there was between there, we see how God's power and how the gospel and Jesus Christ span those bridges or those great walls. Because we know in Acts 8, verses 1 through 25, the Samaritans gave a favorable reception to the gospel of Christ when it came. So we see something that seems to be a wall, impenetrable, unable to get over, unable to build a bridge over. We see that Jesus Christ finds the gospel of salvation bridges that gap, and they accept that. So we'll start next week with some of the sects, and then we'll do some of the developments in the Jewish faith.